On this episode, we talk about Martin Luther's genius and mastery of the media. Welcome to the Anglican Podcast, Faith and Honor. Thank you for joining us. On this podcast, we hope to discuss many issues of interest to Anglicans worldwide on matters of history, doctrine, and values. The following is a recording of us having one of such discussions. It is important for us to know what you think, so wherever you happen to be listening, on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, and YouTube, please drop us a line and let us know what you think. Hello and welcome everybody to another episode of our show. Today I have a very interesting guest, Dr. Andrew Pettigrew, and he is a professor at the University of St. Andrews. He is a founding director of the St. Andrews Reformation Studies Institute, and he is a director of the AHRC-funded Universal Short Title Catalog Project. Hello, doctor. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Well, you have written a very interesting book. The book is titled Grand Luther, and the subtitle is How an Unheralded Monk Turned His Small Town into a Center of Publishing, Made Himself the Most Famous Man in Europe, and Started the Protestant Reformation. Would you speak to us about, just had the context, how you came to write this book? Because in your record of books written so far, you have books in this series of Renaissance and Reformation style subjects. Mm-hmm. So how did you come to write this book in particular?
Well, I started out my academic career working on the Reformation. More specifically, I wrote a book at the for my doctorate on exile churches in London, and then another book on the exile experience and the Dutch Republic, then some more general things on the Reformation. But about halfway through my career, I turned from working on the Reformation specifically to more generally on the history of communication, on the history of the book, on the invention of printing, and then on the invention of news. And it's in this context that my project on the Universal Short Title Catalogue really fits in. That's a bibliography of all books published in Europe in the first two centuries of print, which I run from St. Andrews. So when the invitation came from Penguin to write a book on the Luther celebrations of 2017, which is the 500th anniversary of the posting of the 95 Theses, I thought there wasn't really any point me adding to the huge number of biographies of Luther. I might as well take the opportunity to unite these two strands of my research work, print on the one hand and the Reformation on the other. And that's how this book was really conceived.
And I must say, it's really, just on a personal level, it probably is the best book on Luther I've read, and I don't mean that lightly, but truly, there are so many books written on Luther, and there will be many more coming out, of course, for next year's anniversary. But the central value of what Luther's legacy has been, apart from the theology and apart from the historical consequences of his movement, has been largely missed, I think, and that's the media angle, which is something that's very interesting to me, something that is something I think about all the time, the importance of media, and in particular in the church context, mm-hmm. the mistakes the church has been making in the media, mm-hmm. really in the last century or even more. And so this book for me had an extra level of interest in that you addressed precisely the question I've been asking myself, which is what's missing, and on Luther himself, how did he do it? How did he do this incredible thing almost by himself at first, almost single-handedly? Mm-hmm. And what role the media played in that? Mm-hmm. So can you speak a little bit about what lessons can we derive in a broad sort of overview, mm-hmm. about Martin Luther as a media theoretician that would be of value to churchmen and laymen and the general public today?
Yeah. Well, I think since I turned to writing on the history of printing, the history of communication 15 years ago or so, I have in a way been very lucky, because I've been talking about one major media transition, that is from manuscript to print, in the middle of another, that is from print to digital. And one of the first lessons that struck me as I was doing this is that such transformations are always accompanied by a great deal of false prophecy. People really struggle to understand the meaning of what's going on. And this was true of the early boosters of print as well. Print was widely praised. People were fascinated by it, but people found it extremely difficult to make money from it, because the existing models of manuscript production, which they were now applying to print, really didn't work. And print struggled along for 30 or 40 years, mostly because people were prepared to invest for the fascination of the technology. And then it suffered something quite like the dot-com boom and bust of the 1990s, where the willingness to invest vast sums with no returns collapsed relatively quickly, and print found itself in something of an existential crisis. And at that point, they needed new types of books for new types of readers. And I think that was the main importance of Luther. He came along at a moment when print was attempting to reboot, find new readers, and he gave printers, even in comparatively small centers like Wittenberg, the means to make money. And this is why I think you get such excitement around Luther, and a sort of self-feeding media storm, where once people began to become aware of Luther and his protest against the church and the popularity of his books, the popularity of his books then became part of the story itself. And it became a sort of virtuous circle from which those involved in the industry of printed books could themselves profit.
Yes, yeah, so on the flap, on the dust jacket, you say something really interesting. You say Luther's great gifts are not simply as a theologian, but as a communicator. Indeed, as the world's first mass media figure, its first brand, hence the title Brand Luther. And further down below, you say something that really caught my eye. You say, but that wasn't enough, not just the words, but the medium itself was the message.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that that really resonates with sort of the Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message dictum that I'd like to explore a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Just a second. So, Bart, what do you want to say on this matter?
Well, yeah, I was interested by the idea of, I mean, when I think of Luther mostly as a theologian, in my experience, he has a unique voice. You could give most experienced theologians a sampling of Luther unlabeled, and he does have a distinct style, mm-hmm. and it's very, shall we say, lively.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, Doctor, that was part of his communication strategy, if you will, or is it just him? His personality just cannot escape entering his writing, but in a certain sense, he lacks that, the distance, the cooler sort of scholastic approach, mm-hmm. and instead infuses his writing with a different kind of invectives, different kinds of, I just keep on saying personality. I mean, Luther's character is deeply in his writing in a way that when I think of some of the medieval writers, you really don't seem to have.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. But quite where it came from is one of the great mysteries of the Reformation. When he didn't publish a book at all until he was in his mid-30s. He'd made, by that point, a very conventional, though rather successful, career, but within a very limited frame of reference. And you could say that the 95 Theses were part of that rather conventional career. Of course, he was very angry about indulgences, but he was by far not the first theologian to criticize the doctrine of indulgence. And as a professor, he was perfectly entitled to invite other scholars to debate the issue with him, and that's really what a disputation is. You issue your theses, they are provocative, but in the process of the debate, you have the opportunity to retract them or withdraw them or stand down from them. So you could say that when, so long as his theses were in Latin and addressed to fellow scholars, he was protected from the full consequence of overbold statement. So for me, the really revolutionary moment is in the spring of 1518, when he publishes his Sermon on Indulgence and Grace with its 20 propositions. And I think it's there that you see the real revelation in writing. These propositions are extremely short, extremely clear, seldom more than two or three sentences, and intended for understanding by people of a non-theological education. And of course, they're written in German. And it's at this point that the Reformation really, really goes viral. This work is printed and reprinted all around Germany in an astonishing number of editions in a single year. So whereas it was the Latin work which piqued the curiosity of the international intellectual community, it was really this little work, 1,500 words long. It can be read in 10 minutes. It can be read aloud in 10 minutes. This was the real, really revolutionary step. Now, how Luther intuitively understood that this was the way to conduct a theological debate which would go beyond the faculty is very, very hard to say, because there were few real precedents for this. You could say perhaps Savonarola in Florence, though that hadn't ended so well. But otherwise, it's hard to see how he understood that this was the way. All I can imagine to this congregation helped him find a level and a voice. I mean, I've for many years now lectured to the first year and second year students in St. Andrews to the introductory classes they receive. And that's been very good practice, finding a voice which I think will have a wider, that will meet with wider understanding beyond the university community. And I wonder if Luther came to it in much the same way. But it was revolutionary. I mean, even to call a work as dramatically short as that a sermon might almost seem conscious irony, because sermons in those days were not short. They were very long. They were endurance tests for their listeners, often involving conscious repetition, conscious emphasis, going round in circles. And Luther stepped out of that tradition. So, I mean, for me, the lesson of this is that individuals matter in history, that individuals do have the opportunity and the possibility of making decisive interventions in historical events. And Luther did, I think, by his style of writing.
Indeed, in chapter 2, where you trace some of this early history, Dr. Pettigrew, you say that in 1515, Luther had published nothing. Mm-hmm. And you use words like remarkably conventional, unassuming. Mm-hmm. That was the earliest Luther that we know of. Mm-hmm. And yet, you say, within 4 years, Luther will be one of the most famous men in Germany. So that's the remarkable mm-hmm. story that we're here to trace. Let's speak a little bit about the 95 theses that preceded the famous ones in 1517, because he had another one before that, didn't he?
Yes, the theses on scholastic theology. And you might have thought that this actually was the more controversial subject, because here Luther was making a conscious intervention in the great debate that was dividing German intellectuals on the university curriculum. And he was siding decisively with the moderns against the followers of conventional medieval theology. And he certainly expected that to be conventional, for that to be controversial. But of course, no one came. I think one of the important things to understand about the Reformation is that no one really could conceive of anything of importance emanating from Wittenberg. And Wittenberg was a new university. It was tucked away in the northeast of Germany. It came from a town with very few inhabitants, and it was quite far removed from the major centers of culture in Germany, let alone Europe. So I think when news of his defiance first got to Rome, the Pope and his advisors found it unfathomable that a real firestorm of controversy could emanate from such a place. So Luther put his theses against scholastic theology. He realized he was doing something quite daring. And if you read his correspondence from the first years of the Reformation controversies, when you know he expresses doubts about the level of publicity his thesis against indulgences had received and the potential trouble this could cause. Initially, and ironically, his real anxiety is for the trouble it could cause for Wittenberg and for the curriculum changes they'd made there. And he thought that those who opposed the new form of teaching might well use this as an excuse to go after him.
Dr. Pettigrew, you mentioned in your book that Luther was not dedicated to Wittenberg until a certain time. Mm-hmm. The university there was new, everything was up and coming, and Luther accelerated that. Mm-hmm. Is there any, well, there are a lot of factors playing into this Reformation, which you call very improbable, a lot of improbabilities. Was the fact that the University of Wittenberg knew and any rivalry with Leipzig playing into that?
Mm-hmm. I think so in several ways. You're quite right to say that Luther had no wish to leave Erfurt, a much larger city, a more ancient university, and a more sophisticated place. And by the time he was sent north to Wittenberg, it was the most northerly and easterly place that he'd lived, and he was moving further away from his family and family connections. He set to very dutifully to performing his duties, but I do think his life was transformed when his duties in the university were more augmented by these preaching duties. Because that, from that point onwards, Luther, for a professor and for an intellectual, showed a remarkable commitment to the ordinary man and woman in the pew. I mean, I found an extraordinary letter where Luther, this is by now the point at which he's become a very controversial figure. He's having to respond to his critics. He's having to correspond he's having to correspond with potential supporters or people who are anxious about how things are developing. And he adds almost casually, "And every day I teach the children." And it was astonishing to me that he could fit this in with all of his other commitments, but it was very important to him. And I think this gives him this grounding, which comes through in these theological works that he's writing, but also the works he's writing, works of pastoral instruction and comfort to ordinary parishioners.
As a young man, do you think he thought much about the questions of design that he would be much more concerned about later on? So when you're looking at the first set of 95 theses on scholastic theology, and that doesn't seem to produce much interest in his thought, he produces the second, more famous set of 95 theses on the indulgences. And at first, you say that also does not seem to produce a lot of interest. And that seems to be because, and this is where I get a lot of my interest here, the way it's printed even isn't really well done because of his provincial printer that he relies on. So it's really more when somebody else picks up this tract and then sort of republishes it in the proper, ornate, and elegant style. Is it in Leipzig, right? That's when it becomes a really important work in the history of the church.
Yeah, I mean, the printing history of the 95 theses and also the earlier theses on scholastic theology is very interesting. The putative early edition, the first edition of the Wittenberg theses, the Wittenberg version of the 95 theses, has disappeared entirely. There is no surviving copy. What we imagine that it was published by Johann Rau Grunenberg, who was at that point the only printer in Wittenberg and not a particularly accomplished one. Now, until very recently, all copies of the theses on scholastic theology had also disappeared, and one only turned up in the 1980s, a major find in Luther scholarship. And that's how we bring that to bear on the debate of whether the 95 theses were actually printed at all in Wittenberg and whether they were pasted up on the castle church door, which I think they certainly were, but has been a source of controversy since it was suggested by a theologian in the 1950s that maybe they weren't. The Leipzig broadsheet version of the 95 Theses on Indulgences seems to be a pirated edition, and so it was really with the Nuremberg broadsheet and then the Basel pamphlet that it really began to attract the attention of the wider scholarly and intellectual community. And it was the pamphlet version which the very curious Erasmus sent to his friend Thomas More in England. So it's really through this progression through Germany from Wittenberg to Leipzig to Nuremberg and then on to Basel that it begins to create a sort of intellectual and correspondence itinerary, which was then followed really by all of his pamphlets through the period 1518, 1519, 1520, when he was publishing so very much and so very quickly.
Yeah, in the theses that he published, there is a really wonderful phrase where he says, in his criticism of the indulgences that were prevalent in Europe at the time, as soon as coin and the copper rings, the soul from purgatory springs. And I have often wondered where that came from, and I was surprised to learn that came from Luther himself. So,
yeah, that was alleged to be a jingle in use by Tetzel, the indulgence peddler, and certainly Luther himself puts it in the third person like that. And in fact, something very similar was being said in Paris in the 1490s, because we know that a similar phrase was condemned by the Paris theological authorities back then. So it may be that this was a sort of fairly well-known conventional saying. So what we don't know is whether Tetzel ever used this phrase. And of course, he was monstered by the reformers as soon as people began to take up Luther's cause, and suffered a very grievous fall from grace.
Oh, sure. There's even an even more egregious statement from Tetzel. Tetzel was the seller, the merchant of indulgences, as it were. And this is attributed to him, that he said, this is on page 68, he says, "Do you not hear the voices of your dead parents and other people screaming and saying, 'Have pity on me, for the hand of God hath touched me. We are suffering punishments, severe punishments and pain, from which you could rescue us with a few alms, if only you would.'" So there was a clear, to any sort of clear thinking person, a clear merchandise in misery, in pain. And Luther might have been interested in reforming that. But I'm interested in the mechanics of how, despite his passion in it, his actual work itself that he nailed to the castle door at Wittenberg didn't succeed in arousing interest. It was only when it was designed in a way that was appealing, that's when people began to have interest in his thought and criticism of this truly, not the best doctrine to have at the time in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think this, what that quotation which you've read goes back to, is this absolutely crucial development in the theology of indulgence. The papal declaration that indulgence could be purchased not only on behalf of the penitent, but on behalf of others. That is, you could invest money in relieving the suffering in purgatory of your dead relatives. The other thing which was very controversial, as these indulgence campaigns multiplied during this period, was that the declaration of a new indulgence might be accompanied by the suspension of the benefits of previously purchased indulgences. Now, that was very much resented, because if you had invested already in purchasing an indulgence certificate and then a new one came out, and if you were in danger of dying during the lifetime of that campaign, you had to, this insurance you purchased was no longer valid, and you had to buy a new one. And that, I think, was the cause of a lot of the resentment which greeted the St. Peter's indulgence. And leading figures in the Catholic Church were perfectly aware of this. Extensive had been the sale of indulgences in the previous 20 years that they rightly anticipated the likelihood of a certain indulgence fatigue. And that is indeed what happened.
It's a really wonderful story, really, really compelling. We meet Luther here in 1517. He is an Augustinian monk in his mid-30s. He's had his hand in some academic work of sorts. It wasn't very successful. He's now had his first foray. Now this is actually being talked about. And there's this figure of his printer. This printer that is basically a monopoly on printing in Wittenberg. Which, by the way, Wittenberg itself must have been a very small town.
Yes, it was very small by German standards. It was very small, very out of the way, and perhaps most importantly of all, it didn't have much of a sort of merchant aristocracy. Most of the local merchants were pretty small men. And it was only the determination of Frederick the Wise, the Elector of Saxony, to make something of his capital that really brought any sort of a luster to Wittenberg at all.
And yet, the printer that Luther was saddled with didn't have much interest in elegant printing, did he?
Well, he probably, if we reconstruct, and this is something that historians of print now do, if we reconstruct his inventory of type, if you go through all the extant books and measure the typefaces, that you find the bigger shops have between 8 and 20 different fonts they can use. Fonts in different sizes, and also a mixture of black letter, a Roman type, and italic, and then some decorated initials as well. In a little print shop like Raoul Grunenberg's, which really potted along, mostly doing rather small works for the local professors and things like dissertation theses for the students. You didn't need that many fonts of type. In fact, he probably couldn't afford that level of investment. So this gives these works a far more monochrome and plain appearance, because bear in mind that one of the skillful adaptations of printing as against manuscript was that they often used different fonts of type, different sizes of type, different styles in order to provide natural breaks in the text and highlight certain sections. And Raoul Grunenberg couldn't do that because he had a fairly plain selection. It must be said that for all his faults as an artisan, he was a very firm supporter of Luther and very loyal. And Luther, for all his tirades against this man's inefficiency, did tend to return that loyalty. He was very generous to Raoul Grunenberg, and whatever he thought of his work, he continued to give him work, even when there were now better print shops established in Wittenberg, largely through Luther's own initiative. And that's one of the other remarkable things about him. He sees a problem. He sees that the quality of the printing doesn't match the importance of the message, and he sets to do something about it.
Well, that's exactly it, isn't it? That the quality of the print doesn't match the importance of the message, and that seems to be a rare insight in history in general, and just applying that insight to the church today, we don't care much about the quality of our print today. You know, not only print in the literal sense of print material, but any kind of visual media seems to be an afterthought for us. And yet, for Luther, this must have been a paramount question.
Yes, it was, and it was one to which he now addressed himself in a systematic way. He saw that Raoul Grunenberg couldn't cope. He couldn't cope also in the sense that he just couldn't keep up with demand, and Luther's works were sitting there in manuscript waiting to be printed. So he actually reached out to a major printer from Leipzig, the nearest major center of printing, who came over to Wittenberg and auditioned for the job of setting up a second print shop in Wittenberg. And he did it by bringing some samples of his far more sophisticated inventory of types and showing him the sort of work that he could do. And Luther was clearly entranced by this. I mean, one of the things that I think comes forward most in all of this is that Luther was not a detached, distracted intellectual. Many of the writers of the 16th century thought that, you know, when they'd written their words and handed over the manuscript, the job was done. They didn't really have any understanding of how many working men were required to turn a manuscript into a saleable book, and then to bring it to its readership, to sell it, to recover the money, to recover the investment, and make some sort of a profit. So relationships between authors and print shop managers were never good in the early years of print. Luther, though, and I think the lecture, he did someone as someone who understood the artisan labor required to turn his words into a saleable product.
Well, what about the fact that even the Roman Catholic opponents of his didn't seem to present an interest in style in the way that he's done? This is actually, I think, the most interesting aspect of the book for me. He seemed to have been a visionary in this emphasis on style. Just as you say on the dust jacket, that the medium is the message. And he understood that in a way that not only we don't understand today, mm-hmm. but even his own contemporaries didn't understand then.
Yeah, I think his Catholic opponents were in a very difficult spot. In the first place, in the early years, I think the papacy thought it could be handled through informal channels. They'd have a quiet word with the leader of the Augustinian order in Germany. He'd have a quiet word with Frederick the Wise. And one way or another, it would be sorted out and Luther would be silenced. When it was clear that wouldn't be the case, part of their argument against Luther was that it was not really proper for laymen to be involved in this debate, that this was a proper debate only for clergymen in the learned language of scholarship, that is Latin. So faced with this barrage of German works, the dilemma was, do they reply in German and break their own ban on lay involvement, or do they continue to write in Latin and really cede the field to Luther? And what happens is they do a sort of mixture of the two. The people who write against Luther are very capable. Johannes Eck drives Luther into a corner at the Leipzig disputation, and probably scholars would have thought he won it. But what just wasn't the appetite in the buying public to hear them. And they increasingly began to believe, when their works were grudgingly published, seldom in more than one edition, they began to believe that the printers were part of a great conspiracy to promote Luther and deny them their hearing. They began to suspect media bias, which is a concept that we're all familiar with and a term hurled around in most major political debates. In this case, I think they simply lost out because the printers were reluctant to print books from which they could not make money when they could make such easy money from printing Luther. For most of the printers, they didn't have a strong commitment to Luther ideologically. Indeed, quite a number of the printers who took up his cause in places like Nuremberg and Augsburg and Basel and Strasbourg had actually been involved in printing indulgences only a couple of years ago. So theirs was a purely pragmatic decision, that Luther was where money was to be made. This is the genius, if you like, of pamphlet economics. In the early print world, if you've got a big book, you could only sell anything just as when the whole book is printed. So if it's 100 sheets long, that's probably 100 days' work. The book is long, you need to transport it, if it's Latin, all around Europe. in order to find its audience. And then the money has to come back to you. Often you're not paid in cash, you're paid in books. So it's actually very difficult to make money from big books. A pamphlet of 8 or 12 pages can be printed in a day or two, and often it will sell out almost immediately to a very local audience. And so you save all of those on costs of transportation, money exchange, so on and so forth. So this was the ideal sort of work to regenerate an industry that had been failing in the years before, and in particular to help print shops in small places like Wittenberg, which couldn't lay their hands on the major investment capital of printers and publishers in the major cities of Germany. And it's no accident that as a result of the public interest in Luther, printing started in about 30 different cities in Germany, where either it had never been there'd never be a printing press, or where there'd been a printing press which had started and failed several decades before. So the question is often posed, could there have been a Reformation without printing, which is a real issue. But what I've been trying to do in this book is turn the question round and say, not what did printing do for the Reformation, but what did the Reformation do for printing? And I think what it did for printing is it showed the industry that the way forward was with a different type of reader, a much wider social strata of potential readers than the traditional book readers of the medieval world. In that respect, it was the existential change which the new innovation required.
Right. I think to me, the most obvious strength of the book is in showing precisely that the print as a medium was already in existence by that point for 70 years, 67 years.
Yeah,
right. Correct. It didn't seem to change much for anybody at that point. In fact, you go to some length to show that after an initial spurt of a little bit of an experimenting with this new medium, just like today we might have the web as our medium or social media, people might dabble in it, but they might say, well, it doesn't seem to work. And they might go back to, you know, printing and whatever used to work before as their fallback method.
Well, I mean, James, isn't that kind of the question hiding in the background here? I'm reminded of the invention of the automobile, right? What was it called before that point? It was the horseless carriage. And you really don't get the mentality or the right idea of car or truck until you have something like Henry Ford come along, right? And when you have, in some sense, I don't think the church and many other institutions and where we find ourselves understand the technology, what it actually is. The same way I think we're going to find out with artificial intelligence and robotics and with self-driving cars, we really do not understand the technology of what of what's come out. We have these entrepreneurial spirits, these people who actually put it to work, that will make it mean something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things of technological change is that for those who invest, they often have to take a real risk in guessing how consumers will respond to new innovation. And consumers are both fickle and sly. I mean, what tends to happen, I think, in the world of communication is that the producers are making a big gamble that people are going to not only adopt new technologies, but they're going to abandon old technologies. And that tends not to happen. Consumers tend to take on the new and at the same time just to enjoy a wider range of available media and keep on using old technologies. When I came into the profession, my tutor said that, you know, by the time I was ready to write a book, books would be dead. Well, you know, we now see 30, getting on for 40 years later, books are far from dead. It doesn't mean that people haven't adopted new technologies, is that they just use script mixed together in those bindings. So it is extremely easy to make wrong decisions. And I think this was the problem facing the digital technologies in the last decades of the 20th century, even now, is people could master the technology relatively easily, but how to monetize that technology was a really far more difficult question, particularly when so much of it was available for free. And I think in the news world, that's a problem which people still face today, that they haven't really worked out how to make money from new technologies. Now, what Luther taught people, totally accidentally on his part, because he never made any money from his printed works, was how to monetize this new invention. And that's why he was so precious to the communication industry.
Right, no question. Luther's greatest impact, apart from his theology, was in connection with what Bart said, just how unafraid he was of the science and the technology that was flourishing around him. And perhaps the Roman Catholic Church at the time was in a position that all of Christians are today, in that we're all sitting here and we're a little bit terrified of all that's going on, right? Whereas if we are to take Luther's lesson and really look at it very, very carefully and very closely, what we can learn from this is that there are opportunities here, opportunities unseen and unknown. And without dabbling in this sphere at all, we risk missing out, as in fact the Roman Catholics did with Luther. And he just left them behind and just went off on his own into a huge trajectory that was basically unstoppable at that point.
Yeah, I mean, some distinctly self-harming decisions were taken. And firstly, they gave Luther breathing space because there was a change of guard in the rulership of the Holy Roman Empire. Maximilian died, Charles V came along. That gave him a space, the hope that they would persuade Frederick the Wise to hand him over. That gave Luther a space. But also, there were some decisions taken which didn't need to be. You could take issue with Luther's theology, and he could have been condemned without necessarily the traditional authorities banning the vernacular Bible. Now, that wasn't universally the case. In some parts of Catholic Europe, there continued to be translations of the Bible, but that was a very self-harming decision. By ceding the Bible in the common tongue to Protestants as if it were Protestant property, that gave printers, publishers, theologians, preachers the opportunity to make that association between Protestantism and the Word of God in the common tongue, which was not inevitable and was, on the part of the Catholic authorities, a major misstep.
Right, so perhaps like today we might say something like, I don't know, the internet or Facebook are the property of millennial agnostic youth, whereas if it were channeled and harnessed by youthful Christians and clergy and various kinds of initiatives in the church and for the church, it wouldn't be seen as a secular and or secularizing influence that it now, or at least for now, seems to be. You have a very interesting passage here on page 105. You say, in 1515, right, Luther is in his mid-30s, is unknown, he's in this unknown town, a very, very small town with very little of industry or anything like that. And then in the 2 years, 1518 and 1519, he becomes Europe's most published author.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go on to say further down, in these 2 years, Luther had written 45 original compositions. 45 in just 2 years. I think of bloggers that are slower than that today. You know, 20, you say 25 in Latin and 20 in German. And by the time you say he appeared at Leipzig, there was an eyewitness from the Roman Catholic camp that describes him as gaunt and very, very frail, not frail in a way that seemed to be about to fall over, but in the sense of very skinny and very bony, even, I think he says. Luther was writing every single day, it seems like, and he discovered a vein, discovered a trajectory, a path that was going to sidestep the strategic mistakes that men like John Huss, 100 years prior to that, have made when they were isolated by the Roman Catholic Church and actually executed, and ended up in a way failing to galvanize a wider audience apart from parts of Bohemia, right? Or John Wycliffe in England also likewise was isolated. His works have never been printed until after he was dead, right? So in the pre-print world and also the pre-Luther understanding of what print can do and what media can do, you could easily isolate someone and squash them like a cockroach and no one would know. And historians 100 years later would then slowly uncover traces of this person. Whereas with Luther, you just couldn't stop him, could you?
Exactly right. I think Luther realized fairly early on that his principal protection lay in maximum publicity. It would have been extremely dangerous to Luther had his opponents been able to portray him as a lone wolf. And actually, this is where the Latin works come in, because Luther was an accomplished Latin writer, and his defenses of his teaching were often published in Latin for an edition for fellow scholars. And it was the reading of those Latin works that persuaded many capable men in other German towns to get into their own pulpits and say, I agree with Luther, promote Luther's works. And that spread the circle of his supporters in important ways, so that when people then went out into the market square, found piles of his pamphlets, they might be inclined to read them, and so on and so forth. It suited the Catholic hierarchy to portray Luther as a lone scholar crying in the wilderness. But that became increasingly impossible when it was clear he had supporters all over Germany. And that really is why it's so important that the Reformation became very quickly a popular movement. And indeed, if you look at the data we've collected in the Universal Short Title Catalogue, which is freely available online, you will see that he was indeed the most popular published author in the whole period to 1600. That his popularity is not only very quick to develop, but it's also remarkably persistent. So yes, he'd become, by 1521, the most published author in the history of print, living or dead. He'd overtaken all of the classical authors like Cicero. He'd overtaken Erasmus, I think much to Erasmus's irritation. And he retains his popularity right through to the end of the 16th century and, I think, into the 17th century.
We just don't think, I think, of Luther as such a voluminous author. In my own personal case, you know, I know a couple of works by him that are famous, that everyone should know, right? But when his collected works, his complete works are put side by side on a bookshelf, there is no one bookshelf that can contain them. Is what it sounds like. And so some people that do collect all of Luther's writings in one fell swoop end up having to employ walls of bookshelves sometimes. And we just can't imagine, I can't imagine myself producing that at the very dawn of printing.
Yes, I mean, it's a remarkable oeuvre, and actually, it's never yet all been published in English. The standard edition in German, the Weimar edition, runs to many volumes, and the attempt to render all of them into English, which produced a large row of volumes in its own right, was suspended for many years and is now back underway under the editorship of Christopher Boyd Brown, with I think a further 15 or 20 volumes already planned, so that eventually we will have all of Luther in English, but at the moment it's certainly not the case.
And not only is he interested in writing a lot, but he's interested in being very careful with the way he writes, right? So this is a fascinating criticism that he now has as he's becoming a little bit more famous. He doesn't think he's going to be separate from the church. It's 1518, he's making some waves and he's becoming famous, and he's beginning to criticize his one printer in Wittenberg for all kinds of stylistic deficiencies that you wouldn't think a monk would care about. But I mean, this is Luther we're talking about. This is not a typical monk here. So he begins to criticize Frau Grunenberg, who doesn't seem to care much to get better, right? So Luther does really an incredible move here, which is he goes to Leipzig and he brings with him a contract to get a printer from Leipzig, which was a much more developed town, much more stylistically elegant and sort of visually appealing town, and bring a printer from that culture of printing into Wittenberg. And so this becomes Melchior Lotter. And he ends up displacing Rao Grunenberg, as the default Wittenberg printer, doesn't he?
He becomes he's a very important reinforcement to the capacities of Wittenberg printing, though he doesn't come personally. He sends his son, who sets up the branch office, and there's then this extraordinary double development, which is that Wittenberg becomes much larger centre of printing, with major investment, not least from the painter entrepreneur Lucas Cranach, at the same time as Duke George of Saxony, who rules the other part of Saxony. After the Luther's condemnation at the Diet of Worms, he decides that he will not permit printing of Lutheran works in his lands. So, and this includes Leipzig. So Leipzig printers are banned from printing Luther just at the point when Luther is most famous and his printing work is most lucrative. So this leads to a total collapse of the industry in Leipzig. And it's a collapse from which they don't really recover.
Why do you think Luther had this understanding of typography and layout? Why do you think he put emphasis on that alongside the content that he would put in the books?
Well, I think he had a fairly highly developed aesthetic sense. He was a musician, a practical musician. He liked music. And I think also that the moment of revelation was probably when the first copies of his works printed elsewhere in Germany, in the more sophisticated centres of print, like Basel and Nuremberg, began to filter back to Wittenberg. Now, Luther never made any royalties from the publication of his work, but publishers would sometimes send him copies of the text, publishers or friends, and the visual appearance was so obviously better for these works published outside that Luther began to realize that it would be perfectly plausible to build a major printing industry in Wittenberg, because they had the product, and as long as they got the first edition of all Luther's future works, a lot of the economic benefit could be retained in Wittenberg. And that's exactly what happened. By 1525, not only Luther, but four other printers had been attracted to Wittenberg. And this began a progress to the point where by the end of the 16th century, Wittenberg has grown as a city, but it was also by now Germany's major center of publishing, its largest center of publishing. And that's a progression that can be put down entirely to Luther, not just the powerful nature of his writing, but also his shrewd direction of the industry. It was not uncommon when the state was employing a printer, or when other authors were working with a printer, to give one printer or publisher a monopoly of output on what you're producing. Luther didn't do that. He ensured that the first editions of his new works were spread among all the Wittenberg printers, so all of them got a share of the pie, and that was quite unusual, again, and also very shrewd, because that meant that five or six firms could work simultaneously in Wittenberg, and it became the cornerstone of the city's economic growth. If you go to Wittenberg today, as I'm sure many of your listeners will do during these celebrations, or perhaps already done, the city you see there is essentially the city that Luther built. Three or four streets of a very fine 16th century Renaissance houses, not least the houses that Lucas Cranach built. And these were built on the proceeds of the Reformation, not only the proceeds of selling Luther's printed works, but also the attractiveness of the city and the university now to students meant that students flocked in far larger numbers. This put a certain amount of pressure on the locally available accommodation. It led to some inflation of prices of rent and food, but it did ultimately make Wittenberg a far, far wealthier town. And it's this sort of rebuilding. The wooden houses that Luther found when he arrived were replaced in stone. Extra stories were added. And Wittenberg now is a very, very fine place.
It's really amazing. Wittenberg that is that today began as almost a large village, right? An oversized village.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. Today, the church is commonly saying, woe is me. They see decline. They see a diminishing interest and diminishing attendance. And that's not far off from Wittenberg in 1505 or whatever. And the lesson here is that it's never too late to change course, and it's never too soon to start on the right course. And so Luther takes an unknown town, himself as an unknown monk, and he becomes the greatest writer of the century, right? And there's an incredible trajectory of not only having the initial germ of an idea, but growing in his understanding of the project he's on. So he's not only now printing more, typing more, writing more, he's bringing in scholars, he's bringing in Philip Melanchthon, he's bringing other men into his circle. But he's growing the printing, as you said, exponentially, where there was one lackluster, not too compelling of a printer in his town. He ends up bringing in the best from the nearby larger cities, right? But I think the triumph that I really want to ask you about, the triumph of his vision comes with what you describe on page 148, where you say, when you have these printers come in, like Melchior Lauder from Leipzig, they come in with their beautiful, elegant style, and that's fine and good. But they bring in the style of Leipzig. you say, there was nothing very distinctive to Wittenberg about these books. So Luther brought Wittenberg to now an international level. That's good. He's already good there. Now he wants to move beyond that. He wants to now take it all the way that he can go with this. You say, to create a specific Wittenberg style, the city's printers had to make use of their greatest latent asset. For Augsburg and Leipzig might have had greater capital resources, the longer printing heritage, and the better established print shops. But Wittenberg had Lucas Cranach. So why did Wittenberg have Lucas Cranach and nobody else?
Well, this goes back to the ambitions of Frederick the Wise. Wittenberg was his capital. It was the largest town he got in the division of Saxony between the two branches of the family. So he decided to make a go of it, and he rebuilt the castle, established a university, established a chapel choir. And when he was rebuilding his castle, he invited the major artists of Germany to come and take part in its decoration. They included Albrecht Dürer as well as Lucas Cranach. And Cranach stayed on, and he stayed on to be court painter. And he has a very distinctive style, incidentally, which we can only really study fully now after the collapse of communism in 1989, because a lot of his best work was hidden away in East Germany, as of course was Wittenberg, behind the Iron Curtain. But he built a model of industrial production for paintings. He had an enormous workshop in Wittenberg, and already by the time that Luther became a public figure, Cranach was one of the richest men in Wittenberg. And so he was a supporter of Luther. What he brought to the party was the ability to create these very distinctive woodcut designs, woodcut illustrations for the title pages of his book. And these gave the Luther works of the 1520s, the mature Luther works, a sort of house style, with Cranach's beautiful borders and a central panel into which the title could be put along with the name of the author and Wittenberg as the sort of label. And by separating these two elements out, Luther and Wittenberg, from the mass of text in which they might previously have been, they created not only a distinctive look, so that on a bookseller's stand you could see immediately which were works supporting Luther. Not only that distinctive look, but they then put in bold type the two elements that you wanted to catch the eye, which is the name of the author, Luther, and the place it came from, Wittenberg. And that, to me, is the creation of the brand. That's what gives it brand identity, and it's a very, very modern concept, but I think clearly recognizable here in these 16th century books.
One of the values of your book is these examples of this kind of print. There's several dozen, it seems like, images in your book of what all this looks like, because it's much more difficult to describe it than it is to see it.
I think that's right, yes. And here we're very lucky that the new technologies of today make it far, far easier to illustrate a book than it would have been 30 years ago. Digital photography and the new typesetting print-on-demand services make it far easier to be able to have generous illustration and make the sort of argument that I've tried to develop here comprehensible to the reader.
Right. For those who have the book or will have the book, you can go to page 159. There's one beautiful example there, or 189 has an even more elegant example of the kind of work that these men were producing. And in my mind, I just, well, maybe as a contrast, we can flip to a little bit further on to page 215, where we have a Roman Catholic example of an answer to this, all of this. And, well, I'm not impressed. Let's just put it that way. it's for those listening to us, just imagine a lifeless image of an academic or a state official with cold and lifeless eyes and a bland set of shading that makes you sort of really repelled rather than compelled by this picture. Meanwhile, you know, Kranich is putting out woodcut after woodcut, not only of title pages for Luther's works, but also portraits of Luther as a person and portraits of his wife as well, which if this were a complete episode on Luther's life as a whole, we would have discussed in greater detail. But yes, the Augustinian monk does get married in his 40s, right? And so it becomes a Luther family, Martin Luther and Catherine Luther. So she herself becomes a personage in this whole saga, and her face becomes its own sort of a marker. Even today, I've just recently, preparing for this recording, I went to some Lutheran websites, and you know, they call her Katie Luther today, and what's the image they have of her? It's the image by Kranich from the 1530s, right? So I'm just trying to imagine the complete force of everything that he's managed to assemble here. You've got, first of all, his passion, which everyone knows about. There's maybe four components that I can think of, and everyone knows of the first one, which is the passion and the zeal that he exudes. So you have that to begin with, but then you also combine it with incredible brevity and an ability to compress thought into very digestible, simple chunks, content-wise, right? Then you print it using the best printing available, the most elegant, the most classical, the most well-proportioned, spaced out, the most legible and readable printing there can be, right? And then you, of course, ornament it with the best artwork there can be done in a book using the artwork by Kranich, who was really in the league of...
Yeah, I think that summed it up very nicely. The only thing I would
of course,
would
he was German, so he had his own take on all that stuff. But he was really of a high level.
Enormously is his
so you
courage.
Have this four-level...
For one man
impact,
to stand out
right?
against
and,
the forces
it seems
of his own
when
church,
you put it that way,
in the
not
way he did,
quite as mysterious.
Refused to back down.
Luther
refused to accept
why the movement really didn't
the church.
Disappear. That
and then to
with.
Write and write and take on the burden of the consequences that had for a church I'm sure he loved. That I think is truly remarkable too. The toll it took on Luther was, of course, enormous. And one that he had to live with through the remains of his life. But it was the image of the single monk standing out against the church, which really characterizes these first years and dramatized the importance of what he was saying. And then, of course, in later life, that's replaced by a gentler image, the image of Luther, the family man. And here again, as you say, Kranach was on hand to record it. And it's entirely due to Kranach that we know Luther. We know his face, we know his posture, his demeanor, because of this remarkable series of portraits that Kranach produced of a man who was his friend.
Well, it's truly a larger-than-life saga, and I think this book sheds light on this whole Luther affair, as it was once called, in a way that many historians simply don't. And so, for this reason, I think this was one of the best books on Luther, not just from the perspective of design and media, but just from the perspective of what really mattered and what does matter, and what happened in the past that was so impactful to us today. I'd like to ask Dr. Pettigrew if there is a paperback edition coming out of your book.
Well, the paperback is due out in October. I think in the United States it comes in, on the 25th of October. There'll be another one soon. And in fact, there's a German edition coming out on the 10th of October. So The Germans will also be able to read it in their native tongue as it was possible during the Reformation.
Wonderful. Well, everyone that's listening to us, if this at all is interesting to you, you should definitely go and check this book out. I'd like to thank Dr. Pettigrew for coming on and speaking with us at some length about this interesting topic. I would like to thank my friends Bart Gingrich and Brian Oldfield as well. And we will see you next time.